Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
This show is part of the Grand Embassy Productions.
In this peria sopeli upro dau probindeba Dharma valiana teli sudomo sacerda tendeba
Gamarjoba, and welcome to the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. I'm your host, Roberto, and this is episode 45, Night Attack. In today's episode, we'll cover King Zath II's arrival to Lazica and the Dilemnite raid on the Sabir camp. This show could not run without our wonderful Patreon members who consistently support us month to month to make sure we can keep the podcast going. Thank you to Vivek Dandekar, Daniel Bowline, Marcus Aurelius, Gracie D, Konstantine Megrilishvili, David Montgomery, Quinn Campagna, Emily Bavona, Hal the Legionnaire, Hallie Kunst, Eric Nicholson, Mitchell Dutt, and Andrew Schneider. You are all amazing, and thank you for everything. Also, we will be doing an AMA or an Ask Me Anything for episode 50. Feel free to send in questions about anything you'd like to know about the show, anything that's coming up, anything about me, or whatever you're thinking about in general. You can send it to thehistoryofsakartvelogeorgia@gmail.com. Remember, that's Sakartvelo with an S-A-Q-A-R-T-V-E-L-O, with the subject being AMA. You can also DM me in socials asking questions. Just put AMA in the beginning of the message. Or you can become a Patreon member at the $5 or up tier, join our Discord, and ask it there and chat with some other listeners. Now, on to today's episode. The waves crashed against the ship as Zath departed the harbor of Theodosius in Constantinople. He looked back mournfully at the city, the place he had called home for several years. This grand city where he had been received as a guest. No, he had to remember, where he had been as a hostage to confirm the Lazi kingdom's alliance to the Roman Emperor Justinian. Things had changed in the last few months, as news arrived from Lazica that King Gubazes II, Zath's brother, had been murdered by a pair of Roman commanders, apparently at the behest of Emperor Justinian. The news drained the color from Zath's face once he had heard it. His elder brother, dead? Who would take over the Lazi throne? His own nephews were barely old enough to even do things on their own. The question racked around Zath's head as news of Roman losses in Lazica filled the court. Then, another question entered his head. If his captors kept giving land, would there even be a kingdom for his people left? That all changed when a letter from the Asnauri, the Lazai nobility, arrived. They had asked Emperor Justinian for his continued support and to send Zath to rule over them as king. When the emperor told him this news, Zath was full of surprise. Within a few days, his whole life was packed up and he was given a ship to make way back to his homeland, the place he had not seen since he was a boy. The waves continued crashing along the ship as he made his way along the northern coast of Anatolia. The ship would hug along the coast in the meantime, stopping in the evenings. As the new king of the Lazai, Zath would not need to sleep on the deck in a tent like some of the soldiers accompanying him. Instead, he'd be given his own quarters befitting his noble status. Each stop along the coast would allow Zath to be fed from the food stores, giving him a varied diet compared to those actually maneuvering the ship. Finally, the longest leg of the journey would begin. Departing from the port of Karambis in northern Anatolia, Zath would make the long journey along the Black Sea. There, he would probably have come across some storms, which would keep him in his dark cabin under candlelight. After nearly 2 weeks of travel from Constantinople, Zath would find himself at Dioscurias. With a quick provisioning after the long voyage, Zath couldn't help but be content at being so close to his goal. This is when the final 2 days of the journey would lead Zath to the main Roman fort at Phasis. As Zath prepared himself, he looked at the royal insignia he had been given by Emperor Justinian weeks ago, and he breathed in deeply, getting ready for his new responsibility. The ship he was on docked at Phasis. Zath emerged from his quarters and descended onto land. He had placed the insignia onto himself, which contained a golden crown set with precious stones, a robe of cloth of gold that extended to his feet, scarlet shoes, and a turban embroidered with gold and precious stones. Zath had to do away with the traditional Roman purple for royalty, because that was unlawful for the Lazai to wear. The clasp that held everything together with him contained the royal insignia that the emperor had given him, alongside a multitude of jeweled pendants and other ornaments fastening his golden cloak. The moment that Zath set foot on Lazai land in his royal apparel, the entire Roman army at Phasis greeted him and shouted for his honor, causing the area to tremble. Zath looked at how he was being honored, and the troops formed a procession in front of him, with all of them wearing polished armors and weapons, and their horses on their best behavior. The Lazai troops then saw their king, and tears formed in the corners of their eyes. They fell into line behind him and accompanied him with the sound of trumpets and banners to signify that they were his men and his alone. The procession continued with a magnitude of pomp and magnificence, taking it even further than the Lazai monarchy usually did. When Zath finally took his throne as King Zath II, he worked hard to take the reins of government from the nobility and rule as he saw fit and in accordance with the dictates of his ancestral custom. This is the last we hear of Zath in any sort of writing. One of the Romans accompanying Zath, a court official known as Sotericus, would then set off to accomplish a mission for Emperor Justinian after Zath's coronation. He took with him a large sum of money to distribute to the north to give to the Messenians, a tribal group who resides in the Savinenti region.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois-Burgundy.
Off to the east, Nacharogan marched towards the island of Nessos with 60,000 men under his command. News of Nacharogan's march sounded alarms throughout the Roman camp, alongside the news of a Messimian revolt to the north. The two commanders of the Roman fort, Martin and Justin, son of Germanus, assembled their troops and prepared for a siege of their island fort. The Roman force also contained a contingent of 2,000 Sabir mercenaries bolstering them. The Sabirs are a Hunnic force that lived north of the Caucasus Mountains, in a steppe region where the modern-day Krasnodar region of Russia is, and its surrounding areas. These Sabir mercenaries were under the command of a few different leaders, most notably Balmak, meaning finger, Kutilzis, meaning majesty, and Illiger, meaning prince-man. Interesting names that these lot of commanders had. As part of the Romans' preparation for the inevitable Persian siege, Commander Mardin ordered that the Sabirs go and camp near the plains of Nokalakevi, in order to disrupt any incoming troops crossing over that route and make their march towards Nessos all the more difficult and perilous. The movement of Sabir mercenaries into the plains around Nokalakevi alerted Nacharogan's scouts. The scouts easily found the total number of Sabir mercenaries and reported it back to the Persian general. Nacharogan looked at his options and let out a wide smile at what he could do. He approached a Dilemnite contingent amongst his troops and, as Agathias states, Nacharogan, like the braggart he was, told the Dilemnites to wipe out the Sabir mercenaries completely so that they could not attack his rear at all. A bit about the Dilemnites, though. They are located on the far side of the Tigris River and border the Persian land. They tend to fight with spears, pikes, and wear their swords slung over their shoulder, much like a fantasy character. On their left arm, they tie on a small dirk, and they hold out shields and bucklers to protect themselves. They fight with a form of mixed combat, and they are able to engage in close combat, hand-to-hand fighting, and are proficient with archery as well. Agathias even mentions that they can charge at a phalanx and break the ranks with ease, and just as easily reform their own ranks. They are proficient with fighting on hills, and are able to retreat rapidly with perfect coordination amongst their men. They have long been known to fight alongside the Persian troops, not from compulsion, but just from an interest in fighting, leading them to be steadfast allies to the Shahanshah. With Nacharogan's orders now spread throughout the Dilemnite contingent, they all headed out in the night against the Sabirs, hoping to catch them in a surprise attack and destroy the Roman mercenaries with little trouble. Along the way to the Sabir camp, they saw a Lazi man fall off along the road, and the Dilemnites captured him with utmost efficiency. They put the Lazi man to the question and forced him to show them the best path to the Sabir camp. The Lazi man agreed eagerly to assist the Persians, and he took them closer to the Sabir camp. The Dilemnite troops were taken into a thickly wooded glen, and the Lazi man, almost as fast as he had agreed to help the Dilemnites, had disappeared amongst the trees. After leaving the view of the Dilemnites, he ran hard and fast to the Sabir camp. On arrival, they were all fast asleep, and he let out a loud shriek, his voice booming throughout the camp, saying, "Wretched men! Another minute, and you will all be dead!" The Sabirs jumped out of their beds and surrounded the Lazi man. He quickly explained to them that the Persians had sent Dilemnites to kill them, and that they were on their way to them. The Sabirs rushed to arm themselves, split themselves into two groups, and left the fortified camp, taking cover in the darkness. They also left the entrance to their camp unguarded, and their huts were left just as if they were sleeping through the night. The Dilemnites, having lost their guide, took a rather roundabout way around the forest, mostly because they had no idea where they were going, and it was quite dark outside. It took most of the night, but they reached the Sabir camp, exhausted, right before daybreak. Seeing that their quarry had not awoken just yet, the Dillum Knight silently moved into the camp as soon as they could, lest they wake up the Sabirs. Once all in, the Sabirs, with one move altogether, stabbed into the huts, their spears piercing where the Sabir beds lay. The Dillum Knight seemed ecstatic that they had killed the Sabirs while they were sleeping and began cheering. The Sabirs, in the meantime, rushed out of their hiding places from outside the camp and fell upon the Dillum Knights, who were cheering for their victory without even checking to see why there was no blood on their spears. Now fully enveloped, the Dillum Knights did not know where to go and were caught in the Sabir camp. Despite the Dillum Knights' prowess in close-quarter combat, they were massacred on the spot due to their surprise, with no attempt to protect themselves. Out of 3,000 men that Nachoragan had sent to kill the Sabirs, 800 of these Dillum Knights were killed almost instantly, while the remainder rushed to get out of the camp. Once they had escaped, the Dillum Knights would scatter, but would become confused by the terrain that had confused them the previous night, and would go around in circles, and fall back into the Sabir mercenaries' hands, and at the end of their blades. When the sun finally arose, the remaining survivors had finally recognized where they were going, and ran back to the Persian lines, with the Sabirs right on their heels. Off in the distance, in Nokolakevi proper, Babas, another Roman commander, happened to spend the night in the city. He had heard deafening shouts and screaming from all directions, and he ran up to the city ramparts. As he looked around, the darkness covered what was going on. Once daybreak hit, he could see the Dillum Knights fleeing from the Sabir troops. Taking advantage of this fleeing enemy, Babas ordered his men to rush out of Nokolakevi and attack the Dillum Knight contingent. Between the Sabirs and Romans, the Dillum Knights stood no chance, and from a force that started at 3,000 strong, they had been reduced to less than 1,000. The surviving Dillum Knights returned to the Persian camp in defeat. Nachoragan, on seeing their depleted numbers, did not take the news well. To connect with us, feel free to find us on social media under @history_Georgia or on Facebook at The History of Sacramento, Georgia. Our intro music is Bindi Speria Sopeli by Zadashe. To help this podcast continue, please feel free to subscribe to our Patreon or donate via Ko-fi or PayPal. The links are in the episode description, and you also get access to bonus episodes and access to our Discord, which lets you talk to people if you do the $5 or above tier. If you would prefer donating something a bit more tangible, we also have an Amazon wish list for you to peruse. But the best way to help us is via a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast host, as it goes a long way with getting the word out about the show and helping us reach new people to learn about Georgia. Madlaba the Nachvamdis, and thank you for listening to The History of Sacramento, Georgia. See you next time.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.